This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Wilco Lamb. How are you, Wilco?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. You're the first Dutchman I know that makes wine.
Yeah, there's a few. Not many.
The key thing here is you're the chair of the Wairarapa Wine Growers Association.
Correct.
And Wairarapa is a wine region just beside Wellington, and it includes probably the most famous wine region of Martinborough, which is where we are today on a beautiful hot day.
It's a gorgeous day.
Blue skies, everything. A little bit of a breeze, which helps keep the temperature down a little bit.
Correct.
And it is Waitangi Day, which is the day that in most countries you celebrate the forming of your country. Normally in New Zealand, Waitangi Day is a day of protest.
Pushback, really? Pushback, yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And recognition.
Yeah. So it's quite an interesting day in New Zealand's history. But what I want to talk about today is the Wairarapa and the bigger wine scene in Wairarapa. It's been 15 years since I've done a podcast on Martinborough, and that was with Paliza Estate and Martinborough Vineyards. But we didn't really talk a lot about the bigger region. Let's start off with where, I've given a rough idea where it is, but do you want to tell us exactly where Martinborough is, Wairarapa is, and sort of the climate and things like along those lines?
Yeah, sure. The region called the Wairarapa is towards the east from Wellington in the bottom of the North Island of New Zealand. It is tucked between sort of two mountain ranges. Most of the vineyards are on the eastern side of the Aorangi Ranges for Martinborough, and they extend all the way up further north towards the Hawke's Bay. The Gladstone subregion and Masterton itself are sort of just north of the Martinborough area. So they follow largely the main river that flows through the region. That's called the Ruamahanga. Masterton is the northernmost region, then in the middle we have Gladstone, and then in the south, Martinborough. And even though that's tucked against that river called the Ruamahanga, the Martinborough terraces that the first vineyards were planted on here were all planted around a river called the Huangarua River, which actually originates in the eastern hills here, which is sort of a lot more high calcareous area. So that's quite a pivotal river for this region in Martinborough.
When you say calcareous, you mean limestone?
Limestone, yeah. Yeah. So a lot of that sort of underwater aquifers that feed the vines come from the hills here.
Oh, okay. So it's quite hard water, isn't it?
It's hard water. Not good for your washing machine.
No, or your hair.
Oh, yeah.
My wife's always complaining about how hard the water is in Twickenham and makes her hair not as soft and luxurious as she would like. The original vineyards in Martinborough were on dry riverbed, though, wasn't it? It was
correct. So Atarangi, the late Stan Shifney, which is now Margrain, Martinborough Vineyards, Stan Shifney and Tikaranga, they were sort of the four founding vineyards, or founding, the first one to appear and to have planted. And they were all on what we now call the Martinborough Terrace, sort of the most northern part of Martinborough, probably with the most free-draining soils that were created by that Huangarua River.
And you used to work for Dry River. You were the head winemaker there?
So I looked after the business, the winery and the vineyards for about close to 14 years for Dry River.
And then they got sold off and you basically took the team here.
And then we took the team to where we are today, yes.
Yes, which is the...
This is called Oratera, and what we would call our home vineyard now, the McCrenna block, which was planted by a guy called Jack McCrenna.
We'll talk about that at another time. The first vineyards going in, though, were originally in Masterton.
Correct.
So, which is quite different. And I must admit, we did see some vineyards in Masterton as we drove through, but we didn't really see a lot of vineyards. Mm. Do you know roughly what sort of percentage of vineyards is in Masterton, Gladstone and Martinborough?
Oh, I'm not sure about the percentages. There is a few large investments in the Masterton region. Also a few amazing smaller ones. I'm looking after one of them myself, actually. So there are some wonderful smaller blocks tucked in the hills on really interesting soils, some of them on riverbeds. But I think the majority is really focused on Martinborough and probably Gladstone purely for historical reasons, and not historical as in 150 years ago, but in the last 40 years when wine growing became more popular and the wines sort of got more attention worldwide as well. Mm. The original vineyard was in the back hills of Masterton by the Beecham family. We've actually tasted wine from there, Pinot 17, I think it was. That was an 1897 wine that was lying under one of the original homesteads that had the original vineyard there as well. Gosh. They don't exist anymore, the vineyards, but the wine was still there.
Normally when people taste really old wines like that, they go, that was an extraordinary experience, as opposed to that was a great wine.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly how you could call that one. Yeah.
How did it hold up? Was it turning watery?
It actually was orange. It looked like it was a sort of, what we now would call a skin contact wine. That's how it looked. And it was porty, but it had a really high acidity, so it was almost like a blend between port and maybe sherry. It was an interesting experience, that's right. Yeah, but you couldn't sort of say, oh, this is a fantastic Pinot Noir from the Guadarrapa or anything.
Nice. So there's a few blocks up in Masterton, but mainly Martinborough and
Gladstone.
Okay. One of the things that I've noticed is that we started our wine journey coming down the country at Gisborne. Mm. And Gisborne has no tourism wine tourism, whereas Martinborough is all about the wine tourism. Yeah, I mean, there is lots and lots of wineries based around the square, lots and lots of tourism. It's really quite boutique-y. If you wanted to have that boutique wine experience, you'd come to Martinborough and do that. Yeah. Whereas Gisborne, there's absolutely no tourism. Probably because Gisborne's quite hard to get to and a lot of people don't really go to it, I imagine. But what's your experience with wine tourism around Martinborough?
The wine tourism has really grown maybe only in the last sort of 10, 15 years. There were a few cellar door operators that started fresh. One of them was Poppy's and really set the tone with a cellar door focused wine business. Became very successful, set the tone for a few other people to actually invest not just money but also people and facilities that would cater for day tourism, weekend tourism.
Who was that?
So Jane and Poppy from Poppy's Wines. They were ex-Dryriver as well, decided to start for themselves, and where a lot of people think about investing in vineyards and winemaking, their goal really was, let's invest in the sales facility, invest for where we actually can then make money and reinvest in the business and grow, then grow sort of in vineyard and winery. So probably more logical, but not how people originally started their businesses here. And that was a fantastic example for other people to follow. It's like, okay, maybe if we become a bit more professional in how we sell wine, the business itself can follow and be successful, really. So that then ignited a whole influx of tourists here. And with 1, 2, 3 cellar door operators or hospitality operators, suddenly there is a reason for people to come and go around in Martinborough. And now there'd be few operators or producers who don't have a facility where people can actually go and sit down and have a glass of wine or where the food is being served. So most people now look at Martinborough as like a fantastic opportunity to grow wine, but also to have a direct-to-consumer sales channel, really. And that is then adding to the success of the region because finally there's a bit of a viable existence for people here with small family-owned operations.
Yeah, and the nice thing about that is one of the problems with all wine businesses is selling the stuff. Mm. Making wine is never as tricky as people think it is. It's actually selling it at the end of the day. So starting out with sales in mind and then growing to meet the sales is a much more sensible approach, perhaps.
Absolutely.
And not only that, if you're doing it cellar door, you get the maximum return on the business.
Yeah.
You don't get any better, higher profit margin than cellar door.
Correct. And it's a really fast way to grow your brand because obviously, you know, you have face-to-face contact with your consumers who will become, hopefully, you know, your best advocates back where, you know, when they go to back to Wellington or Auckland or anywhere. So, yes, it's a good way to grow.
In America, there's a lot of direct-to-consumer and they build, or they try and build brands through direct-to-consumer. Are you finding that that once people leave Martinborough, they're targeting the direct-to-consumer market? So instead of going, oh, I like that wine from Oroterra, I'm now going to buy it in the shop. It's a little more like that you're going onto a list to get sold allocations. Is that the sort of thing coming through as well?
Absolutely. So that initial face-to-face contact could be a lifetime allegiance to your brand with your consumer. So capturing the consumer there and being able to follow up with wine clubs or exclusive sales or the pulling power they might have if they go out for dinner or to a wine shop and demanding for your wine when it's maybe not on the shelves, that's quite powerful too. And it's maybe really good to not have them in the shelves because it means that they have to go to you directly.
But also boutique-y.
And boutique. It's
hard for them to. When I've been looking around New Zealand, I haven't had a really good look, but there seems to be a lot of, you know, you've got the supermarkets and those chains, you've got Liquorland and a few retailers, which are high volume, and it'd be hard for Martinborough, a boutique brands anyway, to be in those big distribution channels, just for the volume and the price points that they're really looking for. And we've only really come across one or two specialist wine shops. And I'm not sure, is there a lot more specialist wine shops? I just haven't seen them, or?
They are definitely around, mainly in the larger regions. The specialist wine shops are definitely there, but then also with the specialist wine shops, you're competing with sort of specialty wines from elsewhere in the world, Australia, Europe. So then suddenly, say at a price point of $70, $80, you are competing with other brands at $70, $80. So either there's the commodity Liquorland or the New Worlds, or in the wine shops, they're just both different markets with different type of competition. So one on volume, the other one on price and quality.
Yeah. Let's talk about the wines that are being grown or made here. We've just tasted your wines. You have a Chardonnay, Pinot Gris and a Pinot Noir, but Riesling's also a common wine in the region.
It was, not so much anymore. It's gone into a little bit of an obscurity, and that's mostly because of sort of consumer preferences. They've shifted, I think, quite a bit. Riesling has always been that specialty grape that, you know, that's where you find the real sort of wine lovers that have their little niches. But there's still quite amazing Riesling around, for sure.
Okay. Any other grape varieties?
There is Sauvignon Blanc here, of course. It's a staple variety in New Zealand that I think is really important to producers' portfolio, recognizable for people, and easy to go to variety. Smaller varieties that people play with, Cabernet Sauvignon, very, very obscure, probably. There's a little bit of Pinot Blanc. Everybody's, I think, got their alternative varieties, their experiments to have something as the hook to their portfolio.
I heard there's a little bit of Syrah as well here.
Yeah, there's a little bit of Syrah. Beautiful. It's still, I think, the aim for more consistency is maybe a bit tricky with some of the variabilities in the years and the rainfall or the cooler years. But I've made some Syrah back at Dry River and really, really beautiful. Yeah.
I normally think about Hawke's Bay when it comes to Syrah.
Yeah.
I remember Oz Clark a few years back telling Marlborough that, oh, you guys should get into Syrah. And I was like, they might be able to grow it and they might be able to make really nice stuff, but can they get the volume to make it an economically viable? Because the cooler it is, the less you can ripen.
The longer you'd have to wait for the harvest, and maybe especially for a place like Marlborough, the focus is so much on Sauvignon Blanc. It'll be the smaller producers that probably will be able to make that more viable. But Hawke's Bay, fantastic consistency in their climate, heat units. They're very successful with their Syrahs.
Talking about climates, I understand Masterton has a little bit of frost risk as it's further away from the coast.
Mm.
Is that a serious problem for them? And do you guys have it here in Martinborough or in Gibson?
Absolutely. A frost risk, especially those on the valley floors in the springtime, is there. You would have seen the windmills that are scattered around in the vineyards. Generally, that really suffices to combat the frost damage. There is the odd year that they won't be able to do that with the specific type of frost that is not an inversion, so where the hot air lies on the cold air, that is more a moving frost, then it becomes harder. Yeah, the windmills have been an absolute godsend for us to get better consistency and yield and less sort of impact by the damage by frost.
We're near Wellington. Wellington is known as Windy Wellington. Has anybody ever thought about using those windmills to generate electricity the rest of the year?
Yeah, absolutely. Many people ask. It's like, oh, that's handy. A windmill, you can generate less electricity. The problem is they are not the same sort of build. But here too, you've got Windy Wellington, but we've got Windy Wararapa just as much. And 120 to 140k winds are a reality for us, and that rips through. That can be quite damaging at certain times of the year.
Mm.
But that is exactly what sort of characterizes the style of Pinot Noir and the style of Chardonnay we see here too. That impact of the wind, we see that come through in the wines.
How does it do that? How does it impact the wines?
At tannin wise, so it helps thicken skins, lowers the vigor in the vines. Vines have to be a lot more resilient in terms of combating, because a vine will shut down at a certain type of wind speed. So we definitely see that shutdown happening and the tannin buildup in the skin. So we can turn that into a benefit and a regional characteristic for us.
Do you find the wind dehydrates the vines, as the grapes as well?
Correct, absolutely. Yeah.
All right. So would you say you get more concentration because of the wind, or and does that have an effect on if the vine's shutting down because of wind? And let's face it, it blows consistently. It's not like it's occasionally a strong wind. I was looking at the wind figures for Wellington, and it's most days, most of the time.
Yeah.
Do you find that causes the vine to shut down? Because I noticed in your wines there was a herbaceous character, particularly to the Pinot Noirs.
Mm. I think the concentration, yes, but when a vine shuts down, is all for the conservation of water, really, and for the vine then internally there's still processes happening. So I'm not sure if it adds to the concentration. I think the concentration more comes from availability to water, and with free draining soils, high wind, soils can dry out really, really quickly. So by the time that berry set happens, the region is generally in drought or in dry conditions, and that is the main reason I think we keep small berries here. So it's not until people decide to have an irrigation or that there is rainfall in that period, say around Christmas, New Year's time.
And the last question, we've been seeing Albarino coming through in other regions, and they've been tasting pretty good. Has anybody been playing with it around here?
I haven't seen any Albarino planted in the region here. How that grape variety would settle in. Definitely Pinot Blanc here and Chenin Blanc that people have high hopes for, and I think they'd be wonderful varieties as well. Albarino, let's see, it'll be interesting.
Chenin Blanc's the other grape variety I've been looking at as we're coming through. I haven't tasted a lot of it yet. I've got a few bottles that I need to crack into. We've been buying a few and acquiring a few on our journeys.
Mm.
How are they tasting from Martinborough?
Oh, I think very promising. Atarangi here just released their first Chenin Blanc 2024 of actually an established vineyard. Margrain has planted a bit of Chenin Blanc, now Nawaka. So I think one of the more promising varieties for this region as an alternative to, say, Chardonnay.
All right then, Wilco, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.